We're back. Welcome to Rosie Cole's Vaudeville Broadcast. We took a short break mainly because I, Rosie Cole, was in the process of launching my own performance company. It went very well. We did a show. It was really great. We're called Jim Crack Productions. Please check us out on the Facebook. Jim Crack spelled G-I-M-C-R-A-C-K. This did mean that I did not have the time to do a podcast because I did not plan ahead and get a few lined up. So next time I get busy, I will be more prepared so that there are not 3 weeks of nothing. That said, this podcast is totally worth waiting for because it's with Pi the Mime, and Pi is possibly one of the most fun people I've ever had the privilege of interviewing. So enjoy the episode and check out Pi. His show's coming up at Mimetic Festival really, really soon. He's amazing. Have a great hour. Okay, now on with the show. You're listening to Rosie Cole's Vaudeville Broadcast. This program may contain adult content, so if you're under 18, please either get permission or switch it off. Hello, podcast listeners. Welcome to yet another episode of Rosie Cole's Vaudeville Broadcast. Today, I am incredibly lucky to be with Pi the Mime. Pi, how are you doing? Right. Oh, you were so funny. Sorry, here to translate for Pi the Mime is the wonderful Alexander Lutley.
Hello.
Hello.
I have a voice.
Alex has a voice.
Just about. How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm very well, thank you.
If Pi the Mime didn't give it away, if you could explain to the listening public what it is that you do in case they haven't had the pleasure of seeing you on stage.
Yeah, in a nutshell.
It doesn't have to be in a nutshell, we've got time. So.
Wonderful. Oh, no, don't tell me that, we'll be here all night. Pi the Mime is a very noisy, no, I jest, he is a mime. Surprise, surprise. And Pi is one of a variety of mimes which perform various styles of performance, but most of it is cabaret sketch. Some of it is burlesque inspired. Some of it is classic mime. Some of it more de crew based or dance mime. There is a geisha. There is a geisha mime.
What?
Very different styles of mime, but they all sort of come together and merge a bit. I'm a big fan of merging mimes. So that's a very convoluted way of describing Pi.
Yeah.
He's a bit of a cheeky bugger.
Yeah.
Really, he likes to cause trouble.
Yeah.
And no matter how hard I choreograph his routines, I will watch him on stage and he will just go off on tangents and start playing with the audience. So he's a naughty mime.
I love it. That what you've just described is pretty off the wall, I will say. in terms of what people mainly think when they think cabaret, like you don't normally think like variety of different types of mime, because most people only think there's like one type of mime.
I mean, a lot of people would consider the fact that I have several mimes living in my head pretty off the wall anyway. I have been referred to several people. I'm yet to seek any assistance. There are several types of mime. Mime actually covers quite a range of different performance styles. I would describe it as performance which relies and utilises the visual more than the auditory. However, mine also uses music quite heavily. Just to name a few, you've got obviously Le Coq, which is very playful mime, very, lots of clowning involved in that.
Yeah.
And you've got Marceau, which is much more the traditional white face.
Of course, Marcel
Marceau. Marcel Marceau, yeah. Character-based mime. And then
is that more like Charlie Chaplin as well?
Yeah, Charlie Chaplin comes in there as well.
Yeah.
Very strong character. Quite choreographed in its performance.
Mm-hmm.
With Chaplin, obviously, you have the slapstick element as well.
Yeah.
And then I mentioned de crew already, and de crew is very, very dance based, much more abstract.
Yeah.
Focuses quite a lot on isolation of the body. But that's telling a story through movement and image.
Wow. So obviously you didn't just one day be like, oh, here's Pie the Mime, let's just go. Where did the urge to perform come from? Do you remember when you were introduced to performance as a thing?
Performance full stop?
Yeah, in general, like as a kid.
I've always been a performer all my life, ever since I forced my entire family to watch me put on one-man shows as a three-year-old. I think I was kind of destined to perform, even though there was a weird time during my late teens where, you know, everybody was sure I was off to Oxford to study biochemistry. And then 2 weeks before my choices of university had to be in, I went, no, drama school! And everything went back on track. So there was a little divergence over to science, but no, I've always been a performer. Not mime. Mime was a bit of a weird encounter for me. Mm. But all my life I've been doing musical theatre and Shakespeare and some dance, etc.
Yeah. When did you first encounter mime? Was it when you went to drama school?
Yes, I studied a course called European Theatre Arts, which is a wonderful course. And
whereabouts did you study?
Rose Bruford.
Oh, cool.
Really great school.
Oh, they produce some really interesting stuff, like really interesting performers.
Yeah, it's quite an alternative and new wave approach to performance, especially the European Theatre Arts course, which, in our first year, we looked at all different styles, everything from Stanislavski and psychological realism to Lecoq, which is the first kind of encounter I had with non-text-based performance. Commedia dell'arte, we looked at Laban, we did all sorts of stuff.
Really jealous now.
It was a great... That was a crazy year. I don't think I've ever had that many theatre styles thrown at me. But it wasn't until my second year of uni that I discovered mime.
Was it practical or academic, what you were studying?
It was pretty much down the middle.
Wow.
So it was practice, but very much with an understanding of the theory and the history behind it.
Oh, no, I'm double jealous.
I mean, I'd agree with you, although there were many late nights staying up all night trying to get that essay done. And I'm a writer, but I wasn't when I went. Our second year it was compulsory to study abroad. So as part of the European Theatre Arts course, you study in Europe. And there was this whole selection of places, which was amazing. And we had to choose our first and second choice. So I looked at all these choices and they all did slightly different things. And I'd lived in Spain before and really wanted to go and learn some Spanish. And so there was Madrid or Barcelona. And I quite fancy Madrid. I liked the idea of Madrid. And my teachers were all like, can you speak Spanish? And I was like, yeah, I'll be fine. Send me to Madrid, please. This school sounds great. They do great courses. All the little subjects that they're doing, I really want to take part in.
Madrid,
clowning.
Is gorgeous.
It's a beautiful city as well.
Yeah.
I wanted to live there. I wanted to do clowning. I wanted to do dance. I was really excited about it. And so I managed to persuade them to let me go. And then I got there and realised that actually, when they said I needed to speak Spanish, they weren't lying. And everything was taught in Spanish.
Oh, God.
And so I got to the school and they're like, you can choose any of our subjects. Choose the classes you want to do. I was like, okay. I would like to do classical texts. And they were like, great, fantastic. And then I realised that I couldn't because I couldn't speak enough Spanish. Okay, great. Improvisation. Can't speak enough Spanish. Song, can't speak enough Spanish. So it came down to the fact that the only subject I could really do was mime. So I ended up doing a lot of mime.
Because you couldn't speak a word of Spanish.
Because I couldn't speak a word of Spanish. And
so it was like, just don't speak.
Yeah, it was like, well, you know, have a go at this one then. And I loved it.
That is the best story.
it was a strange first couple of weeks settling in. But then once I got into the swing of it with the mime, it was a wonderful training. Very intense. The school over in Madrid was ridiculously intense.
What kind of training?
So I began nearly every day with 2 hours stood in front of a mirror doing de Croo exercises, which means looking at yourself in the mirror and learning to isolate one different part of the body every day. So there was a lot of vanity or staring at myself.
2 hours.
Yeah, it was intense.
I say that my dance practice is about 2 hours when I do it. But
I mean, you need that length of time to start to get into the swing of it, I think, and then things start rolling. And then I go to acrobatics, and we ended up doing fencing and dance and all sorts of other things as well, which was amazing. Wow. But I did 3 types of mime over there. I did Lecoq, I did Marceau, and I did Decru. And then I got sent back to the UK and had to remember how to talk again, which was bizarre. So yeah, that's how I kind of got involved with mime.
Yeah.
And Pi himself wasn't actually born until about a year after I graduated, when there was this wonderful little notification that popped up on the internet saying, Mimetic Festival is looking to commission a new show. We will be holding an evening where 10 companies will present a segment of their work and we will choose one to be part of the Mimetic Festival. Are you part of a mime, clown, puppetry, cabaret show? And I thought, I need to say yes. I wasn't. Sorry if anyone out there that helped in that project is listening. I wasn't part of it, so and I realised that the deadline was later that night. So I kind of sat there and I wrote what I would hate to read now, but what at the time I thought was a pretty good proposal. And I sat there sort of thinking, okay, so yeah, I'm part of this show. It's a one-man mime show. There are 3 characters, and the main one is called Pi, and he meets the other two, and he falls in love with them separately. And then there's a pirate ship and a fire, and one of them flies through the sky. And there's a big fight, and then all the mimes turn up at the same tango bar and dance a tango together, even though there's still only one performer. And then he has to choose one of them. And anyway, then I ended up having to put on the show. Yay!
What were you doing in the year between graduating and deciding that you were going to just, like, put on a one-man mime show?
Going crazy. figuratively speaking, I was working in a coffee shop because I thought, upon graduating, a sensible thing to do with my remaining student loan would be to buy myself a barista course. Right. So I bought myself a barista course and spent a good 7 months feeling superior because I was not just a coffee maker, I was a barista.
In London.
Yeah, this is in London. Yeah. And I felt kind of like I was just taking the mick, really, and there was something else I wanted to do much more.
Mm-hmm.
I did a children's show, I did a bit of community theatre. I was part of a Japanese show, which was Buto inspired. It was Kabuki inspired.
Oh, okay. I was going to say, Buto's like crazy emotional.
I've since been part of a Buto show, and that was wonderful to be a part of.
Intense.
Very intense. For some reason, the floor was covered in sugar. But no, it was intense. I was part of a Kabuki show, which was interesting. but I hadn't really done anything that was mine.
Yeah.
And I think that's what I was really missing, was my course was very much about creating my own work and deciding who I am as a practitioner. And then I graduated and did theirs and theirs and theirs and just really wanted to do mine. And then Pi the Mime was born at Mimetic Festival 2013.
Oh my god.
And I haven't stopped with him since. He's still here.
Oh.
Yeah.
So. What was it like doing a piece of the work and then hearing them go, like, great, we love you, do your show? How long did you have to make it between sort of your proposal and it going up?
Between my proposal and the commission night, there was about a fortnight, and that was a 15-minute segment. And then between then and the festival was maybe 5 weeks. So it was quite a quick turnaround, to say the least.
Oh my god!
Yeah, it was a lot of fun actually. It was a lovely little show. It's happened a couple of times since then, and it's happening again in November. and has grown, and I've added more mimes. And there was one time when it was an hour and a half long. That was a bit much. Hour and a half, five mimes, one man show.
Oh my god.
On Battersea Barge. So, I mean, imagine the whole thing swaying. That's more or less what happened. So yeah, no, it's grown, it's changed. The five different mimes have all sort of had their own careers in their own way, I guess, and done cabarets or events or parties or whatever. And now they're all coming back together again, which is exciting.
Oh, cool. So what was the audience reception like for the very first outing of the show, which is, I guess, like a year and a half ago now? Almost,
yeah.
Almost coming up on 2 years-ish.
Yeah. Oh, my goodness. It was really positive. It was really lovely, actually. I didn't really know what to expect with a one-man mime show.
Sounds either like the most brilliant thing in the world or like so many people who hate theatre's worst nightmare.
Yes. I mean, one man talking silently at us for 45 minutes and then putting on a dress and writhing around.
trapped in a box for 45 minutes.
There was a box. There actually was a box. I kind of felt that the audience would be cheated if there wasn't. So within the first 5 minute sequence, there was a little quick box. I was like, there you go, that's done. Now I'll get on with the mime. No, it was really positive. I had this one lovely lady who came up to me afterwards and asked, are you French? To which I was like, no, I'm not. I'm from Wales, actually. She was like, oh, well, you look and you move and you mime like a French person, which I can only take to be a compliment. I thought that was, she hated it. But she used to be part of a circus, and she was saying that it reminded her of when she was younger and when she was in the circus. So that was a really lovely comment to take away with me.
That's so sweet.
Really sweet. Totally unexpected. I had no idea how it was going to go down.
So when did you start performing with the mimes on the cabaret scene? Was it soon after Mimetic?
Relatively soon. Mimetic, obviously, is puppetry, mime and cabaret. So there was kind of an awareness there of the other art forms. And I remember, I think it was Alex, who runs Finger in the Pie, watched the show. And the show in its initial stage, initial version, was Pie and his two girlfriends, Amelie the ballerina mime and Mimi the burlesque mime. And I mean, out of 45 minutes, I think Mimi featured in about three. And he came up to me afterwards and said, have you ever thought about doing burlesque? That one character, that sketch, would work really well. And I was like, no, I hadn't. I hadn't thought about doing mime, so let's go for it. And then it started there, I think. I think my first proper cabaret, though, must have been the January after, which was actually a Finger in the Pie cabaret.
Oh my god, no, that's where I met you.
That is where that we
was,
met.
It was February.
February, that's right.
It was
right.
The beginning of February. It's the first Sunday in February.
That's the first time I met you. That's probably my first cabaret.
No.
I was...
You liar.
No, not at all. I was terrified. I'd done a little sort of walkabout with stage moments at a couple of events.
Yeah.
But the first time I'd properly done a cabaret, with a cabaret setup, was then.
Wow.
It was terrifying. I remember sitting on stage thinking, what are you doing? how are you here? Why are you in a bra?
What?
Yeah, it was...
You were so good!
Thank you very much.
I remember I was really happy I was in the first section because I could come out and watch the rest of the show and I think you were in like the middle bit, and I just remember sitting there being like, holy shit, that guy's the best burlesque performer I've ever seen. Just like, not even best boylesque, like best burlesque performer.
Thank you.
I think it's the dance, the fact that, like, because you've had so much dance training and physical performance
training. Not actual
dance.
I've had physical performance training and an addiction to the American series of So You Think You Can Dance. So that's probably where that comes from. But, yeah.
So, you know, if you learn to mimic and then you look at dancers, you start to pick up
their,
sort of their stylization.
Exactly. I've always had musicality. And I guess mime is all about looking at something and taking it and mimicking it. So I guess I've just absorbed 8 series of So You Think You Can Dance. And now I'm starting to absorb a series of other programmes as well. Oh dear, who knows what new mimes are going to be born?
Trying to absorb some RuPaul's Drag Race right now.
I think I am.
Shotgunning that.
Oh dear. I think I tried to sew some sequins onto an outfit the other day, and it's not something that will ever come out of the house.
It's hot glue, hot glue.
It. Hot glue?
Hot glue.
Right, I'm going to home base hobbycraft tomorrow.
It'll all fall off very quickly, but it'll last for showtime. Wonderful. That's all you need.
I tend to do a lot of rolling on the floor. My costumes don't last very long.
So who are all your mimes? There's Pi, who I've seen, and Mimi, who I met that first time.
Yes.
Pi.
Yep. Pi is a little Chaplin-esque clown. Very cheeky.
He's got a bit of a saucy side.
He's got a bit of a saucy side. He loves to flirt with anything and everything. Then Mimi is just total diva. Like, she owns that stage. Comes out in the world's highest heels. Thank you to my friend Jess, who I sent out to buy me some costume, and she came back with stilts, practically. then you've
You're
got...
a physical performer, you can handle that.
I mean, they come off pretty quickly in most of my routines. then there's Amelie. Amelie's a ballerina, music doll, music box doll, like the ones that turn around, the other ones. That's much more of the isolation kind of dance. She's very dancey. Amelie also comes with a puppet. So Amelie is both dance mime and puppet. Mm. So she's going to be making an outing soon.
Have you performed Amelie before?
Not at a cabaret.
But she was part of your original...
She was part of the show.
Show.
Cast de Nostalgie, or A Case of Nostalgia.
Yeah.
Everything sounds lovely in French, doesn't it?
Yeah.
So yeah, she was part of that show. And she'll be making some outings as different guises of the Amelie. So you'll have Dark Amelie and Christmas Amelie and Snowflake Amelie and all different Amelies. Then you've got Sayuri, who's a geisha, and performs Buto and Kabuki and sort of geisha-inspired routines.
Wow.
In this beautiful kimono that I was very kindly given by a family member, or my mother. Let's just cut to the chase. It was my mum.
Wow.
And then there's Zabini, who's the gypsy mime, and she does magic and a bit of circus and is much more grounded and mysterious. And has a unibrow, a little bit like Frida Kahlo.
Oh, cool.
I don't know why, but she does.
Just the way she looks.
Yeah, that's what she wants. That's what she wants to do.
So do the characters kind of like appear to you fully formed and you just start working with them and figuring out who they are? Or do you sit down and kind of... start planning the kind of thing you want to do, or I don't know. That's a silly question.
No, not at all. I'm
like, what's your creation process? Tell me. Give me your secrets.
Very random. I tend to listen to music a lot, and I listen to music and picture performance to it. And because I've worked so much with Pi the Mime and the Mimes, a lot of the performance I picture is mime based. And then I'll often sort of put different mimes in front of that song and the images and the sequence I'm picturing in my head. And sometimes none of them will fit. And that's when I go, okay, I need to create a new mime. Mm-hmm. You couldn't put Amelie the ballerina mime as the geisha, because Amelie is very... She's like a child. She's like a Disney princess. Everything is amazing and magical and skipping everywhere, and she opens the window and the birds fly in and, you know, help her clean, that kind of classic cliche Disney princess film. And the geisha routine was very serious and controlled. And then I was thinking, maybe it could be Mimi. But there's no kind of sexual side, there's no seductive side, or there's no element of tease to the geisha routines. That's much more cabaret than burlesque. And so it just seemed sensible and logical that I created a geisha mime. Mm. And I was watching Memoirs of a Geisha and the name Sayuri came to me. It's a wonderful film.
Yeah.
Thank you for inspiring me. So yeah, I think there's possibility on the horizon for a New York street mime.
So I was going to say, out of your five mimes, one identifies as male, or that you would typically read as male.
Yeah.
when they come on stage.
Yeah.
Is that conscious or is that just characters?
I think that was that largely came from the play, in which originally it was Pi and these two love interests who, to differentiate, I made more feminine and people identified as women. And then when, in the next version of the play, there were four, the other two, although Zabini, the gypsy mime, is not quite so clear, but Sayuri, I would say, is identified more as a female. But no, there's no reason in particular.
Mm-hmm.
Part of me is thinking maybe Pi needs some male mimes in his life.
Yeah.
There's plenty of scope for mime. A couple of the cabaret and burlesque sketches I've done cross between them. So there seems to be a grey area where, for example, the metamorphosis routine.
Yeah, Nine to Pi.
Nine to Pi is very much Pi breaking into almost Mimi at the end.
Mm.
But he's still got that cheeky Pi element. There's not so much of the tease of the seduction. It's more of the clown. It's more of the chaplain.
It's like Pi just enjoying dressing up in women's clothing, really.
Yeah, it's more Pi imitating Mimi, almost. Yeah. Or wearing Mimi's clothes.
Yeah.
So I guess there
it's like layers of mime.
I mean, it's very complex. It's like it's like multiple personality disorder or something. So yeah, I think that's in the future.
Obviously, you, as with a lot of performers that I love, play with gender a lot in performance.
Mm-hmm.
When did you start realising you didn't want to be sort of restricted by your, what people see as your gender? Like,
so as we were talking about before,
yeah,
I had a particularly genderless childhood until I was 18. In that my family just let me be. There was no kind of, you are born in this biology, thus you must have these colours and you must play with these toys and you must hang around these people. There was none of that. And we also travelled a lot.
Mm-hmm.
So I never really settled in any culture or group of people long enough for the novelty of me being the newbie, the stranger, the one that's been travelling,
mm-hmm.
to wear off and for them to start looking at other aspects of me, I assume.
Yeah.
But it never was an issue for me until I was 18 and went to uni. And suddenly, everyone is obsessed. And everybody was like, okay, who are you? What are you? Who do you want to have sex with? And it was like, well, where's this come from? Like, I mean, that's a bit of pressure. You're quite forward. Do you want to
know? That's so funny. Do you mind me asking, how come you travelled so much as a child? Was it travelling lifestyle or was it army brat?
No, my parents teach English as a foreign language.
Ah.
So they would go here and teach, or there to teach, or this country to teach, and I'd just go with them.
Of course.
Which was amazing.
Do you have siblings?
Got a little brother.
Oh.
Who is 17. Yep, no, he is 17. No one panic there. And he is currently studying circus.
Oh, cool.
So we're quite the...
Whereabouts?
At Circomedia in Bristol.
Cool. They've just started a degree programme.
Yes, he might be, I don't know, continuing on to. I think he wants to look at other schools as well and maybe go abroad and study.
Yeah.
But
circus is such a funny one. You know, like, as much as you can get a degree in circus, like...
It's about the training, isn't it? The experience.
Kind of, it's part of it. It's just so learning on the job.
Yeah. You know? 100%.
There's only so much that like a degree can teach you about circus, I guess.
I wonder if there's going to be theory involved in that.
I think there is. There is at National Centre,
yes.
For sure.
Yeah,
absolutely. They make them write essays about it and learn the history, which I really respect.
Mm.
I think that's really cool.
Yeah, I think it's so important to know where things come from.
Yeah.
And where things are going, and have your own perspective of where you want things to go.
Yeah.
Really important.
Yeah.
So it's just me and the little brother.
And also, history is such a great place to steal ideas from.
I mean, all of my ideas are stolen. All of them. It's perfect. There's just such a resource of hundreds of thousands of years of material.
Yeah.
I mean, those dinosaurs came up with some wonderful stuff.
Yeah. Use it.
I think that's my next...
They're not alive to see it being stolen.
I was going
to
say, that might be my next mime. Tyrannosaurus
Dinosaur
mime.
Amazing.
Mime Rex. Velociraptor mime.
So cool. So when you got to uni and everyone was kind of like, so what are you? Who do you have sex with? What do you do?
It was bizarre. It was a lot of pressure on me, and I didn't really know how to behave, because I'd only ever behaved as I wanted to. And for me, that is very much based on, oh, I've woken up, how am I feeling this morning? Oh, I want to wear a three-piece suit and go for high tea. Or today I want to put on a G-string and a dicky bow and pretend to be a naked butler. Some days I fancy wearing a dress, some days I fancy wearing, not getting that bed at all. And so for suddenly to have so much focus and attention on that tiny part of me as a whole, and try and push it into a box, was very strange. But not having a gendered upbringing, I was allowed to express masculinity, femininity, any innity I wanted to really express. And then getting to university, everyone was like, ah, so you're feminine or you're masculine, but you have a feminine quality. Thus, this must mean blah, 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 blah. And to me, it was just kind of, it's not really any of your business. Just get to know me as a person and we'll see how it goes from there. Why do you need to...
It's so funny because when people who identify as heterosexual meet other heterosexual people, they don't go, so who do you like to fuck?
Yeah.
But when they meet someone who doesn't seem heterosexual to them, they're like, so are you gay? And it's like, well, I just sleep with whoever I sleep with. Thank you very much.
I mean, it's weird because it's... There was a real fight I think I had in university where people would say you have to fight for and be proud of, and I'm a massive supporter of being proud of who you are. I don't see that one aspect as what I have to be proud of. I'm proud of myself as a whole. So to suddenly have all this kind of focus and pressure almost to be proud and march down the street and yell how proud I am and tell everyone how proud I am, and people will come up to me and I'll be like, yes, I am this, and I'm proud of it. When some days I'd wake up and be like, today I don't really want to be that. Today I want to be a cat and lie in the sun. I mean, I don't know. For me, it's a bit of a grey area, I think. And I didn't cope particularly well with all of that pressure.
Mm.
Just because I didn't understand why anyone really had to know.
Well, also, if you've never experienced that before, to go into a world where it suddenly is so important, that's such a huge culture shock.
Massive culture shock. I found it incredibly difficult to... I mean, I tried to fit in, because obviously everyone tries to fit in.
You want some friends, don't you?
Exactly. And it seemed like the people that were most interested in me were the people that, you know, thought I was A, B, C, X, Y, Z, and thus understood this, and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But for me, one of the major drawbacks is that if someone looks at you and says, are you this, are you X, Y, Z, and you go, yes, that label, and it is a label, comes with its own expectations and preconceptions and stereotypical imagery. And I guess sometimes I conform to those expectations and sometimes I don't, but that's because I'm a three-dimensional person, not a cartoon character.
Yeah.
And that was something I was finding really difficult, is when people would not chastise me, but be surprised or laugh and think I was behaving strangely if I didn't behave in the stereotypical expected way based on the label that they decided I had.
Yeah.
And that for me was like, whoa, I'm being 100% restricted here. I don't really know how to break out of this. Yeah. And I mean, when I say these people, these aren't horrible people. These are wonderful people who are some of my closest friends and people who I look at and admire.
Yeah.
Because they are such whole people. But I think the definition of the word person, individual, is that we're all completely different, regardless of if we all like to go to this place or if we all have this colour hair or whatever. We all are individuals, and so we can't really expect other people who might fit into part of our lives to behave in the same way as us.
Yeah.
And that's something I fought with for quite a while.
The labels are very, very restrictive. I mean, in some ways there is power in a label because you can get behind it and you can affect change with it.
Yes.
But then, like, how much of it do you sacrifice in terms of restricting your personal freedom to be who you want to be?
Exactly. And it also, I think, there has to be almost an awareness and a memory and just a consciousness of what that label represents and what fighting for this group of people or this collective or this category means.
Yeah.
Because I think there's a lot of misguided people who just jump on board label because finally I found my group.
Yeah.
And
people are really tribal. People love to be in groups with people.
They do.
We're social animals. Even if you're a loner.
You're alone with the other loners.
Yeah, exactly. And you've got to, there's got to be a group that you identify at least against.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, you're a loner because you don't identify with the other group. But I'm sure if you found...
Don't get me wrong. I'm absolutely fine with other people doing what they want.
Mm.
I have no issue with anyone being whoever they want to be. And if you want to be in a group that identify as A, B, C, D, whatever, wonderful. But don't force those views on me, and or don't force me or don't expect me to be part of that group because you assume I'm also of that same belief system. You can have it and I'm not going to judge it, and I love listening to it. But yeah, I have to have an understanding that we are all individuals regardless of who we fuck. There was this focus on my label, and then there was this list of do's and don'ts and how to behave, and if you did that, it was fine, everybody would get along and it was really fun, yay, great, we're all the same. But for me that was shallow and I was playing a part, and there was quite a lot of it I didn't agree with. And also I was really bad at it. I mean, I tried really hard to be part of this label. And there's this really funny story I tell about how... So one of the labels I would often get identified with was gay, which is neither here nor there in anyone's business, really, in my opinion. But, you know, there would be gay day, and the gays would go on gay day, and the gays would go to gay day, and they'd go to gay clubs. And that's fine, and I have no problem with any of this. I mean, there are other things I'd rather do, but...
Sometimes it can be fun.
Sometimes it can be fun, and I went along with it at the beginning of uni. And then we used to do this thing called the circle, and we'd get into the club, and there'd be this little hand signal, and it was like this, which you can't see because this is a podcast. This is the mime.
I can see it, and it's very exciting.
But it meant, let's do the circle. And the circle meant we would walk in single file around the club so that everyone had seen us and we had seen everyone. And this was part of the stereotype of the character of the do's and don'ts, the personality that I was terrible at. Because you would have everybody else involved in the circle walking around this club looking $1 million like they owned the place, and everybody would be like tripping over themselves to look at them and say hello. And you'd have me at the back of the circle, and I'd recently dyed my hair like salmon and decided I wanted to curl it, and was wearing a waistcoat and large flare trousers and resembled a little bit of a Victorian prostitute. And I was just so bad at the circle.
Sounds like a Victorian prostitute or a 70s clown.
Yeah, it was
like
very...
like American curly wig clown.
Yeah. Although the curls all fell down the right side of the face.
Oh, okay, I see. Right. I was just thinking like, you know, like both of the clown. A massive clown.
I mean, I should try that. Maybe I'd be better at the circle with that kind of hair. But I was so bad at the bloody circle. And I became really self-conscious and was just really concerned that maybe I was just really bad at my label, and then realised I didn't want to be part of the label. I just wanted to just be me. And
that's so funny. I also have this image in my mind of like this circle of incredibly good-looking gay men wandering around this club, and then Pie the Mime at the back almost like imitating their walks.
It was more or less like that because, I mean, I have beautiful friends and they are all wonderful and so full of character and so intelligent and full of personality. And this all shone through when they did the circle. Unfortunately, the only thing that shone through about me was that I was a bit of a klutz. And not and
I bet that's not true.
No, it entirely was true. And I mean, I would try and look at the others and learn how to do the circle. And one of them would have this wonderful, like, steely-eyed gaze. And the other...
Smouldery.
Yeah. And so I'd be walking around with the smouldery, and then there'd be another one who'd have the perfect, like, lips just parted pout. And then there'd be the other one who'd, you know, just have his t-shirt just hanging casually off his shoulder, showing his muscly arm. And then there'd be the other one who'd have the sort of the slight swagger. And, I mean, it looked great when they did it. But... I was just terrible. I was absolutely ill. I remember one of them took me to Brighton. We had the best night out I think I've ever had in my life. And he tried to teach me to do the circle. And, well, first of all, the first part of the story is that I was terrible. And he left me alone in the middle of the club and said, right, dance for a bit and then do the circle pose. And so I danced and then did this sort of slightly parted lips and steely-eyed gaze and what I perceived to be the circle pose. And literally nothing. And then he came over to me like about 3-4 minutes later and was like, okay, we're going to go for a cigarette because you look a little bit like the child from The Exorcist. And then we went outside and this man came up to me and was like, can I borrow your lighter? And I was like, I'm really sorry, I don't smoke, I don't have a lighter. And his response was, I'm terribly sorry. I thought you were a lesbian. Which I don't understand. Because do all lesbians carry lighters? Like, A. And B, maybe that's why no one approached me.
That's something you have to do when you're, when you're a lesbian, is always make sure you get a lighter on you.
It was just the most confusing evening of my life.
How you do in the lesbian club.
Well, that's why they don't let me in. That's what it is.
You always come to the lesbian meeting without a lighter.
I'm so sorry. I'm so sorry. I'm so bad at this. I just don't fit. So yeah, that was there were some really funny memories that I can look back and laugh at now. But at the time, it was deadly serious. The circle was like,
oh my god,
the be all and end all.
That sounds like a joke to me.
Now we all laugh about it. But at the time, you know, I needed to be good at the circle, and I wasn't.
But we all look back on things that, when we were younger, that really, really mattered, and you're like, oh God, oh God, why is that so important?
I think part of me is still, I think part of me now goes, oh, it doesn't matter because I'm bad at it. I mean, if I was any good at it, I'd be like, no, it's really important. But no, the circle's not important because I'm rubbish.
I never did that.
And I think it was a reflection on all of that that kind of set me off on exploring gender and identity and sexuality and religion and all of these kind of labels that people have, and sort of studying them and seeing how they can be explored with and being more fluid.
Mm.
I had a very interesting conversation once on the bus. Well, it was a 3.5-hour coach journey, so I couldn't really escape. But it was me, and I sat next to this guy, and he, as soon as I sat down, he closed his book and put it away. And there was this obvious kind of sign that he was like, ah, I have a neighbour now, so we're going to have a talk.
Oh, God.
And then we got talking, and actually he was a really lovely guy, and was a Catholic priest. And so you've got the gender-bending burlesque dancing mime and the Catholic priest, and we had a conversation about labels. It was one of the most fascinating conversations I think I've ever had in my life. Because, number one, I think, obviously, the label of Catholic has its own preconceptions and its own kind of judgments and do's and don'ts and how they're probably going to be and what they like and what they don't like.
And then priest on top of that.
And priest on top of that.
And then Catholic priest. And, together.
And then coach. and actually, he was amazingly open-minded and grounded and wanted to listen to, you know, what I did and why I did it and what I thought and my views and, you know, didn't agree with all of them, but not in a kind of, I don't agree, you should change, you're a sinner, but in a kind of, I don't agree, I come from this perspective, it's really interesting to hear what you're saying. And that for me was, again, it was just such a kind of flashing light that's going, labels are bad, we all try and categorise each other, I'm guilty of it myself,
mm.
We all go, oh, you are this, 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 and this, that's probably you aren't going to like me or get on with me. Or we, you know, we won't have anything in common. Whereas, in fact, we're all individuals and we all have little parts of our life that maybe cross over and are similar.
Mm.
And that's what I think I'm trying to push with some of my theatre companies and my performance. And not necessarily, it wasn't with Pie the Mime until actually a gender specialist came to see my show and had a conversation with me after about how interesting a comment I was making about gender, and I was like, am I? I didn't realise me dancing around in a thong and a bra was making a comment about gender. Very naive.
When was that?
That was on Battersea Barge.
Right.
Last November, maybe, around that time. Which was when all five mimes were there.
Yeah. And like an hour and a half show.
Crazy. Crazy.
On a barge.
On a barge. And it was rocking a lot.
Oh, good old barge.
Good old barge. But yeah, I think it was then that I kind of, it clicked and I was like, okay, this is obviously something I'm really interested in.
Mm.
And that is going to seep through whatever I do. It's a very strange kind of, I don't know, people sort of go, oh yeah, so you're the mime. You're the funny, quirky mime. Cool. Done.
Yeah.
And actually,
you're one kind of mime as well.
Well, that's what we started the conversation with, is that there are even many styles of mime.
But nobody knows that. People just think, like, trapped in a box, pull on a rope, baguettes, onions, stripy shirt.
Exactly. That's the massive,
on the street, leave me alone.
I mean, don't mention Mimi on the street. That's a totally different style of performance. But I think that's exactly it, is that they hear mime and they hear label and they hear, oh, I know exactly what you are.
Mm.
And I'm like, well, I'm not just that.
It's the same when people hear clown. They think scary clown from It, or they think
kids clown.
Yeah, kids clown. Kids party clown's a bit weird.
Mm. Yeah, I mean,
kids party clowns are a bit weird.
Very weird. But then you've got clowns like Dot Cotton, who are just genius. Absolute genius.
Yeah. Dot, who's just on the live podcast, people.
There we go.
Listen to episode 14 and you'll hear Dot being very eloquent for someone who doesn't speak in performance.
I mean, there are many of us. Many of us silent, eloquent types.
Yeah. Well, you silent people should speak more.
Well, people just keep casting us as silent people because they've labelled us now. They know we're the quiet ones. But no, it is this massive kind of culture that's so used to putting you in a box, which is, you know, mind box, no pun intended there, but so used to sort of restricting you and going, you can do this and that's it. And then, and people that are happy with being put in that box and going, oh yeah, that is all I can do and that's all I will do.
Yeah.
And then people like myself who were like, let me do other stuff. I want to be a living statue covered in sparkles.
Yeah. It's like when I say to people, I'm a belly dancer. I have to go, I'm a belly dancer, but I'm not that kind of belly dancer. I don't wear sequins at all. I never have sequins on my costume. And actually, the style I do is like this and this. And I have to go into a spiel about what I do. Because when you say belly dancer,
they go,
you think of a specific thing. And if I was like, I'm a belly dancer, but one of my favourite shows I did, I was an android with wires coming out of my stomach and fake blood everywhere, and I looked like a character from Blade Runner.
Is that like, full Cabaret Roulette?
Yeah.
Is that the one that's coming to the birthday?
Yeah.
Very excited about
that. Oh my god, it's one of my favourite things I've ever made. Thank you, Vivacity Bliss, for giving me the platform.
Just thank you, Vivacity Bliss, full stop, I mean.
Yeah.
Nine to Pie was born from Roulette as well, and it was just wonderful.
More of that needs... More... I think on the cabaret circuit, particularly in London, I think this has come up on the podcast before, is like it's more industry-y than other cabaret scenes. So it's very like, you have a package, you market your package, you get paid to perform. Whereas some of the best cabaret, I think, comes out of the idea that you are just playing with an idea. And I think there needs to be more nights that maybe pay performers a little bit, that say, hey, we can pay you to play with an idea.
Yeah.
Here's an idea, go.
I think that's a really great idea. I mean, you can't... Well, I don't know. My personal experience is that I can't sit in my studio and go, right, I want to do this act. Here it is. Da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da. Done. Nice and shiny. Great. Let's put it in front of an audience. Because I put it in front of an audience, the whole thing changes. Now, that's usually accompanied by a large internal argument between myself and Pi.
Yeah.
With me going, why are you doing that? Prime example, the very first time Pi performed, Pi does this beautiful sequence. Well, at least when I choreographed it, the idea was that it was a beautiful sequence where he is on this pirate ship and he starts swimming through the water, and it's all very, you know, classical mime, and a lot of very quite tricky mime sequences and movements that I've been taught over the years, which I tried to put all into the same sequence about sailing. And then when he was in front of an audience, Pi got into the boat and he's swaying, and oh, there's the big wheel, and he's steering, and oh, there's the big pole. Obviously, I'm very accustomed and comfortable with boat terminology.
The main mast.
Yeah, that one. Didn't know you were a sailor.
I'm not, I just really like pirates. Oh,
perfect, you should see this routine.
I can't wait.
There's the main mast, and he climbs up and he looks out, and ooh, and then he releases the sails and he climbs back down. Oh, and then, oh, look at the water, and I'm going to go for a swim. And he dives, and he starts swimming, and then he reaches the land, and he gets out of the water. And that, anyway, that was the choreography. Except the first time in front of an audience, he decides to do all of that. Puts out the sail, climbs back down. Oh, I want to go for a swim. Jumps in, is swimming. There's a shark! And then I remember, as myself, like, looking at Pi, thinking, why have you done that? Because he added the shark. And yeah, then it was a definite moment where Pi the Mime decided, I'm going to take a back seat and let Alexander Lutley do the next bit of performance where he deals with this shark. And then left me dealing with the shark. And then once I managed to escape the shark, Pi comes back in and is like, and he climbs up onto the beautiful island. And he's just meant to go for a walk through the island. And he goes, there's an Irish dance troupe. Why there was an Irish dance troupe, I will never know. And then he decided to take a backseat again and leave me dancing at the Irish jig in front of this audience.
It's like improv with yourself. It's like being part of an improv troupe where you're like, a good improviser always says yes to the suggestion and just has to follow it through. It's like improvising with yourself.
It's probably not helping the conception that I'm a little bit loony. But I'm actually arguing with myself on stage constantly.
I think you're just more in touch with your subconscious than other people are.
Possibly. Or elements or characters of my subconscious.
Yeah.
Mimi and I have arguments very regularly. Mimi wants to get very naked. And I actually, which is a very strange thing to say, I'm not particularly comfortable with nudity.
So interesting.
As Mimi the Mime, I am. Well, I'm not. Mimi is.
Yeah.
Mimi loves getting naked. Mimi's like, I like my body. You like my body. And we all like my body. Take pictures of my body. And then I'm there going, and I come off stage and suddenly realise, Mimi's gone now and it's me. And I'm naked and really uncomfortable. And it's happened so many times that I've taken off far too many clothes. And then Mimi's decided to take a back seat and be like, deal with it. And I'm just being like, great. Now I'm stuck on stage.
But I think everyone has that in performance, whether they're doing it through a character or not. Where they suddenly get, like, in the zone and they start doing stuff. And then suddenly they get out of the zone and they're like, how did I get here?
Yeah,
what am I supposed to do with this?
Why is my bra on the floor? Oh, dear. Honestly, Sayuri the Geisha is probably the worst at dropping me in it. It's a Lecoq technique called le jeu,
mm-hmm.
which is usually between more than one person. I think.
Except now
that I, you know, my multiple personality disorder is kicking in. But it's where you put the other person in, and I put this in inverted commas, the shit. And they have to sort of deal with it.
La merde.
And I feel that my mimes, Pi and the rest of them, are constantly doing that with me. They're constantly playing le jeu. And leaving me in difficult situations. And sort of going, deal with it.
Sayuri's one of the worst ones for it.
Sayuri, that geisha, honestly. Devious. Devious mime.
Oh, do you want to talk about the triangle that you said?
Your
triangle.
My triangle.
Because it fits with what we're talking about. And it seems so central to your...
To my practice.
Yeah. And it's also, this is a chance for you to say this is my idea so nobody else can take it.
Yes, copyright. And if it already exists, then please don't sue me.
Sorry, I came up with it independently.
I didn't see it. I haven't read it. No, so, yeah, it definitely does tie in with labels and with this kind of preconceptions and stereotypes that happen in society. And it's the sex, gender, sexuality triangle, which I created for my thesis, which I am very slowly trying to convert into a book about identity. And
this is your thesis for Rose Bruford?
Yes.
Yeah.
So there were two. There was a practice and a theory, and it was my theory thesis. Say that 10 times after a glass of wine. So there was the triangle, and the top of the triangle was sex, which I used as a term to mean either a biological sex, gender, which was more of a qualitative aspect, so masculine, feminine, you know,
yeah,
that scale, and then sexuality.
So most thinking people are able to separate three, but like sex is your body, gender is how you present yourself to the world, and sexuality is who you're attracted to.
Yeah,
like that's pretty.
Yeah, and it's a very basic triangle.
Yeah.
Obviously, I am totally aware that there are many subcategories, and I probably don't sit on the triangle myself, but it was an attempt to create something which could explain how a lot of society would see things,
mm-hmm.
which was sex, male or female,
mm-hmm.
and we know that there's more than that, but sex, male or female, gender, masculine, feminine, sexuality, gay or straight. Now we know that there are others for all three areas, but to simplify it down to how society view it, it was just kept like that for now. And the idea of the triangle is that you should be able to guess you being a person in society, that in a society that labels and has these preconceptions, the third point of the triangle from knowing the other two. So for example, if the sex was male and the gender was feminine, you'd put those two together and try and guess their sexuality, which would be
probably gay.
If the sexuality was straight, and
it would be confusing.
But for example, if the sexuality was straight and the gender was feminine, the sex would be
female.
Most probably. Now, we all know this isn't true. We being open-minded people who aren't so obsessed with labels.
But if you're thinking about general consensus,
is
man on the street, woman on the street,
that's kind of how it goes.
Yeah.
And for me, that was very limiting because, well, obviously, I have a massive issue with gender and with labels.
It's not even a box, it's a triangle. You're taking away a side.
I mean, there's a whole other side there that needs to be considered. Well, I'm not quite sure what that is there, so don't put me on the spot to think of a fourth category. But no, it was this kind of idea that also people will meet you and they will judge the third part of that triangle by whatever two that they can grasp. And then that's it. Forever. And that's what they know, and that's what they expect, and then there's a whole list of categories and aspects that will go along with that label that you've just been given from the combination of these three labels. Mm. Whereas I argue that it's much more fluid than that, and people shift and change, and one day you may want to wear this, and the next day you may want to behave like this, and the third day you may want to see this person.
Even within sexuality, I mean, you know, what was it, 30, 40 years ago, Kinsey was like, hey, actually, it's not gay or straight. It's a scale. And there are 6 points, which is still a bit like simplifying it a bit.
Yeah. I saw actually a picture of the 6 points today. And then there was like a seventh one underneath that went unusual. And the person that had taken the test had got unusual. Which is another way of saying weird or abnormal or not within a category. And although I think that is a step in the right direction, I almost feel like this scale has to have kind of like the volume control that you can just slide it up and down.
Mm.
And I mean, from personal experience, I'm not particularly good at, this is a bit of a sidetrack, but a lot of people find that quite frightening, especially when you tell them that on the first date. They're like, oh no, he's going to wake up tomorrow and suddenly not find me attractive. Which is not the case at all, obviously. If you find someone attractive, you find them attractive. But it's this kind of ability to not be stuck in one place forever. I find it really strange that there are all these sort of blueprints in society on how to behave. And then we spend almost the first 18 years growing up with these blueprints, which I didn't have because I grew up all over the place. And then 3 years defining them and finding yourself. And you're 21 and you know who you are. And that's it. Done. Great. This is me until I die. Still have no idea.
Yeah.
And I love that. And I think, who will I be tomorrow? Who will I be in a week? Who will I be in a month? Who will I be in 10 years? I don't know. And that's great. And that's really liberating. And if more people could accept that, and I don't say it's wrong to settle in something at all, but you know, if there was a step made by as many people as possible to accept that some people don't want to define themselves as something, they just want to be free to just keep floating and find, and you know, they find people and together they float. Maybe you find someone who you connect with and you become a partnership and float together, that's fine. But if there was more acceptance given to that fluidity, we'd live in a much better society.
Yeah.
And there'll be a lot more people allowed to express themselves and a lot less of this awful prejudice and sort of narrowing behaviour that exists at the moment in society, which is really limiting.
Yeah.
Which is why I love the burlesque and cabaret circuit, because I feel like that's taking a step in the right direction.
Definitely.
Obviously, labels still exist within it, but...
But the fact that you can get on stage as a mime that does burlesque sometimes, but also does all these other things, and people go wild for it, that's
wonderful. A good thing, isn't it? It's wonderful.
Yeah.
And the fact that you know, the people you meet and the people that come to see it, and it's just a lovely little part of society where people relax and go, you know what? I don't know who you are. I don't know who you're trying to be. I don't know what you are. I don't know what you want to be. But I'm happy and I'm enjoying myself being near you. And so that's fine.
That's it. Fun.
And it's fun.
We just have a lot of fun.
Whatever happened to people having fun? No one has fun anymore.
Oh, I got too serious.
Everyone is very serious. I mean, that's why we studied arts.
To have some fun.
I want to be a kid all my life. But yeah, so it's something I'm hopefully going to keep pushing, and I've got other companies. I've got a children's theatre company who really use the element of play and interactive theatre and allow for all children to do all activities, whether it's make paper boats and race them down the stream or colour in butterflies and stick them on a dress. Like, I'm not going to stop you because you wear a cap and you wear a skirt.
Oh, it does start in school, doesn't it? That idea that, like, I've had so many conversations about this as well, but, like, you are good at science or you are good at art. You can't be good at science and art because they're not in the same category.
I mean, I'm a scientist. I was off to do biochemistry.
Yeah, and zoology. And it's like, okay, if you're good at art, you can either be a musician or a painter. You can't do both.
How about we put paint in the musical instrument and see what happens? Like, why is everybody so...
It's not the expensive one.
Just like, of course, yeah. Yeah. And as a singer, I don't think you should put paint in my musical instrument. Please. But, yeah, no, it is that, isn't it? Ever since... the beginning of my thesis was... I'm going to try and quote it as much as I possibly can. But it said, sugar and spice and all things nice, that's what little girls are made of. Slugs and snails and puppy dog tails, that's what little boys are made of. Often the very first things any of us hear when we're born is, it's a boy or it's a girl. And from then starts this pre-decided journey of where you'll go.
Yeah.
From the moment you are born.
Before, when if they decide to figure out what sex you are in the womb.
I mean, people already are, like, painting nurseries of the child's nursery to be the right colour for the sex.
The right colour.
And for the gender, because they just assume that, you know, if it's a male baby, there will be a masculine gender. And if there isn't, then we're going to beat that out of him. Or, oh dear, something's gone wrong.
Yeah.
And it's this kind of strange approach to growing up of, hello, I can't even think for myself yet. And you've already decided what I'm going to say and do for the rest of my life.
Yeah.
Which is bizarre. I think if we almost had a less kind of structured, you will grow up and you will get to this stage and you will know who you are. I think it's kind of constant exploration and learning about the self. I think that would be much healthier.
Yeah, there's a pressure to decide who you are and what you do. I mean, who you are, where did you come from?
I don't know. And I think I have my family to thank for that, and to blame.
Yeah.
I guess, because a lot of it, obviously there are times when you go, ugh, it wouldn't be so much easier if I just fit in. But, you know, that kind of open...
But then you did try. You did try and it didn't necessarily work.
That's true.
You gave it a good go.
I mean, didn't necessarily work is the understatement of the millennium. It failed horrendously.
But that's okay.
Yes. I mean, failure. Actually, that's another one of my big topics that I love to talk about is failure. Because when I was in Madrid, I learned how to fail. Because I did it very often. And my attempts at integrating and performing and responding to instructions in Spanish and communicating were often horrendously wrong. And I learned to be okay with making mistakes and being wrong and not being perfect and failing. And actually how failing can often be more wonderful than succeeding.
Yeah.
And I think that's another thing that...
You learn more.
Exactly. And actually, as someone who's done a lot of clowning, it's often a lot funnier.
Yeah.
Or a lot more touching, a lot more real.
Yeah.
And I think there's so much pressure to succeed at everything. And there's not enough space for you to explore, mess up, fail, and enjoy that. And learn how to turn your failure into a success. And learn how to and allow people to enjoy the fact that you failed. Because I fail all the time.
My mum likes to say, she goes, this is very American of me, but every setback is an opportunity. Just like...
No, it's deep, but it's true. It is true.
It's such an American thing to say.
It's so true, though. And it's totally connected to that idea of failure, in inverted commas.
Yeah, because, I don't know, I just think, like, if you did something and you were really successful, it's like, where do you go? Where do you go from there?
You...
Like, what do?
Try and succeed at something else.
There's just nothing to explore.
No, exactly. And failure, I think, is very human, and that scares a lot of people. But that's fine. Mm. I think being scared is good. I'm terrified 95% of the time of everything.
Mm.
And it's great. I mean, oh, I've got to get up on stage in front of a load of people and take my clothes off.
But... It's like that image where, I don't know if you've seen it, it's sort of a joke Venn diagram where there's a circle and it says... Inside it says your comfort zone. And then there's another circle really far away from it and there's an arrow pointing to it going where the magic happens.
Yeah. It's so true though. If you stay your entire life within your comfort zone, I mean, I guess some people are lucky and their comfort zone happens to be what people want. Especially when talking about arts. But you have to push, you have to explore, you have to throw yourself in the deep end. And I mean, I'm constantly doing that. I'm constantly writing off to festivals and saying, I've got a show, and then saying, great, and then me creating it. And it being fine, because I've thrown myself in the deep end, I've allowed myself to go, right, sink or swim. I want to swim. I'm not a huge fan of sinking. And then creating something with the space for that something to fail, but complete faith in it, I think.
And when you sink, you find something at the bottom of the sea.
Exactly. Like the Little Mermaid.
I've seen more anglerfish.
Yes, or anglerfish. I mean, that's slightly scary. I might have to watch a happy film like Up. Oh, no, wait. Not a happy film.
No.
I'm sure hundreds of burlesque artists have experienced this. Costumes are another character. They are so prone to misbehaving. Honestly... Either costumes or my nipples, but one of them does not want to stay on the other. So it's just really dangerous. So Alex from Finger in the Pie and Finger in the Pie as a company and myself are running this Pie the Mime meets Finger in the Pie runs cabaret burlesque workshops.
Finger in the pie of the mime.
Not quite sure how we're going to go with that. I think that that conversation has come up several times.
Oh, it's so funny though.
I mean, I'm not sure Finger in the Pie of the Mime is a family show. That's over 18s only.
It would
only.
Be a really funny show though.
Pay extra. I mean, I'm glad you think so. I'm not sure what Pi thinks.
I was just thinking like in your ear or something. I don't know what you were thinking about.
My nose. They've got a really sensitive nose. But no, we're teaming up to do a cabaret and burlesque workshop. Which
I've seen this.
Is exciting. And it's the kind of workshop that combines you as an individual and all of your many facets. So that brings in all my research and my powerful standing on labels. and combines that with the art of the tease and that kind of expression and using your body and this way of performance whilst telling a story through this. So it's not about learning a fixed choreography.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not particularly good at fixed choreographies. My mimes tend to get excited halfway through and run off and do something.
Yeah, you can fix them, and then when it gets to the show, you're like,
there's a sharp.
Yeah.
But there is a level of technical training, there's a level of creative process that I will be teaching, using clown and mime and Laban and Lecoq and Grotowski and all these different things that I've studied in combination with whoever the individuals are in the class to create organic new material that tells a story enhanced by the art of burlesque. Because I would say that's more what I do.
Mm-hmm.
Is I do burlesque, but it's more, I guess I do mime or clown sketches, and burlesque is a part of that. So it's
you're not a burlesque performer that does mime, you're a mime that some of your mime characters do burlesque.
Yeah. Well, I guess some of it is burlesque that does mime.
Mm.
I think it's combining these different performance styles and art forms and trying to tell a story and trying to convey an emotion or a character through them. Because that's what I'm about. Is
just trying to entertain people for a bit.
Yeah. I'm about theatre and entertainment. And that's what we'll be teaching. So it's kind of a course that will be very much linked to acting. Because obviously that's one of my main trainings. But also movement and physicality, and I teach singing as well, so there'll be some singing in there, and bringing all these things together and going, who are you, who do you want to express on this stage, what do you want to express on this stage, great, so, oh, you sing opera, fantastic, and you want to create a weird old man character, fantastic, a weird old man opera singing character that does burlesque, this sounds fantastic and I can't wait to see the act. Let's get using clown and mime and all these different things to create something.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the idea of the course.
Oh my god, that sounds amazing.
I cannot wait.
Oh god! I've almost forgotten this. This is almost the second time I've forgotten this. To end almost every podcast.
Yes.
I ask the question, what's the best thing that's happened to you on stage and what's the worst thing that's happened to you on stage?
Oh well, this is a difficult question. Especially after our conversation about failure. are we keeping this to cabaret?
No, just stage.
Just stage in general.
I've got some great worst ones. I don't really have very many best ones, but I've got some great worst ones.
Best one. Best and worst. A particularly bad experience for me. I seem to do a lot of performances where I get there and everything's all well and good, and then the stage is carpeted. Which is fine, except I'm not your classic, you know, I'm up here dancing on my feet, ooh, you know, here's a little bit of this, a little bit of that. I tend to throw myself at the ground and roll around a lot. So I've often got covered in quite a lot of carpet burns, which is pretty unpleasant. There was one amazing performance where I really enjoyed the performance, minus the carpet burns. I did my routine, and then all I was told before was, someone's going to come on and murder you, just go with it. And I was like, okay. So halfway through my routine, I get jumped. And someone, like, wrestles me to the ground. And I'm like, oh, this is the part where I die. And so I did the most dramatic death you've ever seen. And then they cut out my liver and squeezed it, and I got covered in blood. And I was like, oh, okay. Then they cut out their heart and squeezed that, and I got covered in their blood. And then they died on top of me. And then we both got dragged off this carpeted stage. So it honestly looked like I was an angel that had had my wings, like, sawn off. That was a particularly pleasant onstage experience in the moment of when you're there going, this is amazing, my liver's just been cut out. And an unpleasant exit.
What was that for?
That was for London Alternative Market.
Oh, okay.
I mean, I didn't enjoy the carpet burns. Someone might have, but it wasn't me. So that, I think carpet burns, in general, are probably the worst thing that's happened to me on stage. And the best thing would have to be certain audience members' interactions. One of my favourites is very fortunately on video from Cabaret Roulette Metamorphosis, where I decided to get into the audience and I put in inverted commas, seduce an audience member, and then sort of reveal a little bit of my bottom cheek in the expectation that they give it a little slap. And I believe it was, not naming any names, but Lady Maiden Voyage's boyfriend, that instead of slapping my bottom cheek, kissed it. and totally threw the rest of the routine. I had no idea what to do then. I was gobsmacked. I had no idea where I was. But that might be one of the best moments of total unexpected, oh, hello. Okay, I'm going to finish my routine and leave.
Now, there is a man that is very comfortable with all points on his triangle.
Wonderful man. He and his triangle are very much in connection with one another. Be in connection with your triangle. Take your triangle out for dinner. I'm going to get t-shirts made.
Oh, thank you so much for podcasting.
No, thank you.
It was so fun.
It's been really fun. I realise I've gone on for hours and hours and hours.
Where can people find you out in the world? What are your internet links, if people are curious?
Pie the Mime on Facebook is probably the easiest one. If they want to look at me as a person, alexanderlutley.com.
Mm-hmm.
And that's got links to Pie the Mime and Chamonix Collective, my children's company and everything on there. But yeah, Pie the Mime on Facebook, all and Twitter as well. All details of my shows are on there.
Pie spelled P-I.
P-I.
Like the mathematical figure, not like pie as in finger in the pie.
No. Finger in the pie is a very different pie. Totally different. It's like apple pie. Not Pie the Mime. So yeah, on there, and there's details of all the things I'm doing, and then on Mimetic Festival website, there's details of my workshop and my show, which is coming up.
Mm-hmm.
Slash.
Anybody wants to sign up for your class? There's still time!
There's still time! Do it!
Yeah.
So, yes, please sign up. Sign up right now, and we're going to have some amazing times and all fail beautifully together.
Yeah, amazing.
Cheers to that.
Indeed. Thank you so much yet again.
No, thank you.
I have been your host, Rosie Cole. You can find me all over the internet. You can find me on rosiecole.com. You can find me on facebook.com/rosiecoledancer. You can find me on Twitter @rosie_cole. Or if you have any comments, anything you'd like to share with me, doesn't have to be about the podcast. I'm going to say that right now. If you just want to, you feel like sharing, you can email me on rosiecoledancer@gmail.com. And audience, as performers, we would be absolutely nothing without you. So thank you so much for listening. And
thank you so much.
A wonderful night. Woo!